This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, Politics in 2012. Why is the gap between right and left grown deeper and gotten so bitter?
We are in an era where politics is as much a sport, and where it's not just good enough to disagree with your opponent, but you need to vilify them and destroy them.
Plus, we'll look at the obstacles that could get in your way as you try to vote. We also profile state Supreme Court candidate Connie Kelly. And calling all brides. Need a dress? Want to sell a dress? Want a bargain? Ann Arbor's The Brides Project puts those dresses to good use. It's a bridal boutique where all the money goes to charity. Those stories and much, much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, talking politics. Is it really so hard for us to all get along, or at least to have a civil conversation with someone with whom we disagree politically? And how much is the media to blame? We'll talk about how we talk about politics. But first, as the clock ticks out the final hours of campaign 2012, we wanted to zero in on the main questions facing voters here in Michigan. Tim Martin is a reporter for MLive based in Lansing. He wrote a piece today titled, Five Questions to Ponder as Michigan Voters Prepare for Tuesday's Election. Tim, you start with the ballot proposals. They are everywhere. You can't turn on a TV or radio, it seems, or open a newspaper without some advertisement either for or against them.
You know, they've spent more than $140 million combined on the six ballot proposals. Those would be the supporters and the opponents. Five of them would change the state constitution, and I believe it is one of the most crowded ballots as far as ballot proposals go since the 1990s.
Other than the voters, who is, do you think, is most paying attention to these proposals?
Well, special interest, I think, would be paying a lot of
right.
The proposals. They're the ones spending all of the money, the $140 million. Most of that money has been spent on just a few of the proposals. One of them is Proposal 2. That deals with guaranteeing collective bargaining rights in the state constitution. That has attracted a lot of money from unions that support it and business groups that oppose it. Proposal 3 has attracted a lot of money. Proposal 6, obviously, is one that you can't be near a TV and miss a commercial for Proposal 6.
You sure can't.
The Maroon family that owns the Ambassador Bridge has been the main funder for the supporters of Proposal 6, and then the business groups that would like to see a second bridge there have been the main folks running TV ads against Proposal 6. So three of the ballot proposals individually shattered the old spending mark, which was, I believe, from 2004, a casino-related proposal that was on the ballot. So three times over, that's been broken here.
And certainly we know Governor Snyder will be keeping a very, very, very close watch on Prop 1.
Yes, he'll be keeping a close watch on all of them. Proposal 1 is a referendum that would give voters a chance to decide, should the state keep or reject a new emergency manager law? Emergency manager laws are put into cities and school districts that are struggling financially. We've had an emergency manager law for decades in Michigan. Last year, led by Governor Snyder's efforts, the legislature passed a new emergency manager law that gives emergency managers more powers. Some of those powers some folks don't like. One of the powers is to unilaterally toss out union contracts. Another is the power that allows an emergency manager to strip locally elected officials of their power. And that's kind of what has sparked the opposition here. And that's going to be, of all the ballot proposals, that's probably the one that polls show is most conflicted. I mean, you'll show there's a poll that'll show that behind, there's a poll that'll show it ahead by a little bit. So that's really probably on election night up to six, the hardest one to get a gauge on headed into Tuesday.
Tim, what's the talk if the emergency manager does not pass and it's seen as a loss for the governor? What's the talk of what will happen then?
Well, it's possible that lawmakers would take a look at another version of a law to replace it. That's not a given. It's also not known really what would be in that measure. I think they've tried to focus on getting Proposal 1 passed, and again, Proposal 1, a yes vote, keeps that 2011 law on the books. But if that fails, I think it is definitely possible that the legislature and Governor Snyder would take a look at some other type of measure, perhaps different than the one that passed in 2011, to kind of replace it and give those emergency managers more tools to do their job.
Let's move on to what you see as the second question, which takes us right into the State House. What's the question there?
A couple of questions there. The first one is, will Speaker Jay Spolger survive an upset bid? There hasn't been a Speaker of the House defeated in a reelection bid since 1992, I believe. So it happens, but it sure doesn't happen very often. Democrats have spent a lot of money targeting Speaker Bulger in his district that runs part of Calhoun County, part of Kalamazoo County. It's, you know, kind of hard to predict what's going to happen there. But it's certainly going to be a far more interesting race on Tuesday than Jay Spolger would have thought he would have had, you know, 6 months ago.
Mm. And also, I guess the big question, will the Michigan Republicans be able to hang on to their majority? They've got a 64-46 edge right now, but with all 110 seats up for grabs, what do you think will happen?
I think most analysts are projecting that Democrats are going to cut into that margin, but might not win enough seats to retake the majority. Could be close. And one wild card in all of this is the districts are new this year.
Mm-hmm.
Every 10 years, Michigan House districts are redrawn based on census population. So the districts look a little different in some cases than they did 2 years ago. Makes it a little harder to predict. But the House has a history of changing hands. Both in 2006 and 2010, it did just that. So that again, will be a very interesting scenario to watch Tuesday.
We move on to your third question, and the focus of that is one native son of Michigan who's running for president.
Mitt Romney, the son of a Michigan governor. You know, 4 years ago when he ran, he spent a lot of time here, and people, I think, may have expected him to do that again this time around. He has not chosen to spend a lot of time here. He sends a lot of family members have come here. Paul Ryan's been here a few times. But Governor Romney has not been here since August. And I think that surprised some folks. Some folks would say he's got other states where he feels he has a better shot at winning, possibly Ohio and Florida, where he has spent a lot of time. Some folks feel that the fallout over the auto bailout issue would hurt him in Michigan, and so perhaps he hasn't spent as much time or resources here as he would have otherwise. On the flip side of that, as little as Romney has been here, President Obama has been here even less.
Right.
I don't think he's been here since April, and that was for fundraisers, wasn't even a public event. So, you know, Michigan, you know, still has a reputation as a battleground state, but that reputation is, you know, kind of slipping. Democrats have won the presidential race here many times in a row. I think it goes back to the older President Bush was the last Republican to carry the state. So it's been a while, and while Michigan is still a battleground state, there are some where the battle's a lot fiercer.
We're going to get into another battle. Your question number four focuses on the race for the U.S. Senate. Do you predict any kind of a possibility of a big political upset for Pete Hoekstra?
Well, I wouldn't predict that. I would think, I guess that's what would make it an upset, right?
I guess it would.
If you went against everybody's predictions. He's got his work cut out for him. You know, if you look at most polls, he's trailed by double digits in late October and early November. You know, he's pulled upsets before, and Pete Hoekstra won a race early in his career in 1992, beating Guy Vanderjack in a congressional primary. And Debbie Stabenow herself was able to pull an upset in 2000, beating an incumbent to get in the U.S. Senate in the first place. But that's a tall order for him to pull off this time around. He never was able to raise a lot of money here to get his message out broadly. He's pretty well known in West Michigan, but I don't think he is that well known in other parts of the state. So if he were to rally, it would be a huge upset.
And your final question, Tim Martin from MLive, is really about us and who's going to show up to vote tomorrow.
That is the key question, really, because, you know, at this point in the game, it's all about which side does the best job getting its supporters out to vote. And right now, we just don't know that. Obviously, 4 years ago, President Obama inspired a lot of folks maybe to go out and vote who had never voted before or hadn't voted in a long time. Very high voter turnout 4 years ago. This time, Republicans say that, you know, they kind of saw that and have responded to it and have spent a lot of more time on get-out-the-vote efforts than they may have in the past. So that's really going to be key because, especially in some of those swing districts in the state house, you know, whoever has the best ground game and is able to just simply get folks to show up on Tuesday could be the winner.
Just out of curiosity, Tim, where will you be on election night?
I'll be right here in Lansing. I'll do my voting on Tuesday morning and come in here Tuesday afternoon, and we'll be setting up a little office here in Lansing where we'll have a lot of reporters at.
And it'll be, I'm sure, a long day and a long night. Thanks a lot, Tim.
Thank you.
Tim Martin is the Lansing reporter for MLive. It has been 1 week now since Hurricane Sandy slammed into the eastern seaboard. The East Coast is hurting, and another big storm is headed their way. 1.3 million still without electricity. Incredible damage to homes and infrastructure. So you might be wondering, those of us in Michigan, how can we help? Jack Aronson and his colleagues at Garden Fresh Gourmet have already donated 40,000 pounds of food to those affected by Sandy. And now they're extending their support, holding a coats and blankets drive today until 6 p.m. and then tomorrow from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. You can drop off new and gently used clothing at the Garden Fresh Gourmet offices in Ferndale. Directions and more information can be found at michiganradio.org. An easy and great way to help families who have literally lost everything. Here at Stateside, we want to connect with you. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Head to Facebook and search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and that's C-A-N-T-Y, and on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Is it just us, or does politics seem downright ugly these days? Defriending each other on Facebook so we don't have to see one more political post from a friend whose politics we can't stand. Unable to talk about the election at the dinner table or among friends. We'll take a look at whether things are worse than ever or does it just feel that way. That's coming up next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. So, tomorrow is Election Day. Have you noticed yourself, your friends, your family members saying something to the tune of, I cannot wait until this election is over? But that leads us to the next important question. What happens on Wednesday? Chances are we'll wake up knowing who won the race for the White House, and most likely who won the other political races. And we'll likely know what happened to the proposals on Michigan's ballot. But what then? Will there be a sense of, all right, let's try to work out a consensus. Let's try to give this guy a fighting chance of tackling our enormous problems. Or will the great divide grow even deeper and more embittered? From coast to coast, it seems as though this election has somehow brought out the worst in America. The polarization, the accusations, the snarkiness, the venom. What has happened in our country and in our state? And what does it portend for the course of our nation starting on Wednesday, November 7th? John Bebo is the president and CEO of the Center for Michigan. Their mission to be independent, nonpartisan, and citizen-led, building coalitions, building bridges to help Michigan. And Vincent Duffy is a veteran broadcast journalist who is Michigan Radio's news director. Now, Vince, you've covered a lot of election cycles. How do you think this one compares in terms of being bitter and nasty?
I don't think that it's any more bitter, nasty, or acrimonious than many of the past elections that we've covered. If you think about the efforts that report against President Clinton to try to unseat him and the anger that many people held towards the second President Bush in those campaigns and the horrible things that were said about the candidates in the last race when it was McCain versus Obama and their colorful vice presidential candidates that got a lot of media. I think what makes it feel like it's different this time is that this is the first presidential race that where social media has really been as prevalent in our lives. And so even in our leisure time, what typically is our leisure time, we are being bombarded with partisanship, and we're seeing more partisanship from our friends, perhaps, than we're used to seeing. And so, you know, we have heard, you know, the talk radio people say bad things, and we've seen certain cable networks go all out against one candidate or another. And we see the political ads on TV and hear them on the radio. But even now, we're getting it from our friends. And I think that that has raised it to a level that we weren't used to in the past. You would talk to your neighbors and you get it at cocktail parties. But now it's, you know, every day at lunch, if you log on to Facebook or you go home and you get on to Facebook, you can't escape it. And you have people now that are defriending each other over political comments and getting into arguments that get rather lengthy on Facebook. And so I think that has added to the feeling that it's more acrimonious this time. But I think from a party level, from the slings and arrows that are being thrown from each party to the other candidate, I don't think it's really that much worse than it's been in the past. It's more of the same, really.
John Bebo, what's your take on as we're winding down at last?
I would agree with Vince. I think 2000 was the election year where I think we saw some heightened partisanship when the presidential race was decided essentially by the Supreme Court, and you remember how long that took. That seemed to kick off a new wave, not the first wave, but certainly a new wave in hyper-partisanship in this country. I mean, look at 2004, the Swift boat ads. That was as nasty as anything this year. 2008, you had some polarizing characters there. Sarah Palin certainly was a polarizing character, whether you liked her or not. I don't think this year is any more partisan on the presidential level. I think to the issue of voter fatigue, I think there are a couple things in play this year. One, it's been an extremely long race, presidential race. In some ways, I thought that was good. I thought the number of debates in the Republican primary was very healthy. I think it wore people out, but it was good. There were a lot of things that were brought on the table by a lot of different perspectives, and I think that's what we ultimately want, even if we get tired of it. At the state level, I think the fatigue is exacerbated by how complex and long the ballot is this year. The six ballot proposals are it takes some study to understand them. My wife was at my office this morning printing out all of our Bridge magazine coverage, and it took 15 minutes to print out the things that she wanted in order to make her decisions tomorrow. So I think it's a complex ballot, and I think that's why we're all a little tired of it.
But there is something that I'm sensing, and maybe it is the Facebook postings. It seems that somehow we as a nation have begun to see our political opponents not merely as wrong, but as evil.
Well, this comes from the, you know, Roger Ailes, Karl Rove side of campaigning, and you know that they are, you know, Republican operatives, and certainly the Democrats have responded in kind, and we are in an era where you know, politics is as much a sport, and where it's not just to good enough to disagree with your opponent, but you need to vilify them and destroy them. And it's, and, you know, it's a game where you know, compromise is seen by many people on both sides as a dirty word. You have to win 100% of what you want or let nothing happen. You know, if you look historically at the country, this is not new.
Okay.
We perhaps, because we have electronic media, are more aware of this. But if you go back to the Lincoln-Douglas debates, horrible things were said about the candidates. If you look at you know, the presidential campaigns before that, when the press was much more partisan than it is now, you know, there were horrible things and vile things said about the candidates by the parties. You know, and maybe it's just that more people are paying attention to it, or it's easier to reach the population now. But there was no time in our nation's history where there was this, you know, polite, genteel campaigns that were taking place, especially at the national level. I think maybe that's just a short-term memory problem. Everything always seems like it's worse today than it was in the past. But there's no history of polite politics that has ever existed in our country. So I don't know that that's really the case.
I will say I was watching C-SPAN a couple weeks ago, and they had a replay of one of the presidential debates in 1992. And Bill Clinton and the first George Bush and Ross Perot were downright civilized compared to what what we're seeing today. I was really struck by that. But I agree with Vince. For whatever reason, I'm finding myself reading in my spare time a lot of Civil War history right now. And the tenor between the two times is there are some interesting parallels. So we're not talking mm-hmm. about slavery today.
Right,
but
right.
just the level of animosity seems similar to that time. As you look forward, I don't know what it is that's going to break that. I don't know what it is that's going to bring us together as a people or what will ultimately split us as a nation. It's hard to see how one leader could rally this country to be on the same side right now. I think the last moment we had anything close was 9/11.
Yes.
But that was fleeting.
Very
and,
fleeting.
And it led to a couple of extremely costly and fruitless wars.
I think that one of the things that makes it feel different now, too, is that when you look at the presidential campaign and the race that John was just talking about, you know, at that time, it was much more difficult to shield yourself from alternative views than it is now. With the way that the electronic media is shaped right now, I wouldn't recommend it. But if you want to, you can spend the months before the campaign hearing only from people who you suspect are going to agree with you.
Echo chamber.
Right, and
yeah.
who give you information that will reinforce your opinion and vilify the opposition. And you can do this, you know, whether you are on the right or on the left.
Absolutely.
Certainly listeners to this program are not likely to be individuals who are shielding themselves from one opinion or another. But I think that contributes to the social ability among friends, neighbors, and families to have a complete lack of understanding of why somebody would think differently, because you're surrounding yourself 24/7 or throughout the course of a campaign with like-minded viewpoints, and when those individuals who are spouting that material demonize the other side, after a while, I think you're likely to agree with that. And then you want to then demonize people who agree with the demons of the other side. And it becomes, you know, like you said, an echo chamber.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with John Bebo, the president and CEO of the Center for Michigan, and Michigan Radio's news director, Vincent Duffy, talking about can we get along politically and as a nation, and what will be happening the day after the election. You've both pointed to this demonization that can happen from basically listening to people who agree with you, and the lack of consensus, which leads me to question what can get done within either Congress or in the state legislature when you have this entrenched sense of we're not talking to them, I'm not getting on the elevator with him. And we have heard stories anecdotally from people who walk through the state capitol and say, you know, they used to go out, maybe they would fight hard in chambers and then go out and have a beer together, and you don't see that so much. Are we paying in terms of bills not getting acted on and action not being taken?
Well, we're taping today in Ann Arbor, and there's an Ann Arborite who speaks quite well to this, Tony Dezinski. Tony D. has been on the city council here, and he's a former state legislator. And he talks eloquently about that back in the day when he was in the state senate, they would fight tooth and nail, but they would go out for a beer afterward. And he doesn't see that today, and I spend quite a bit of time in the Capitol, and I don't see it either. You saw this year with the election scandal in Grand Rapids with Roy Schmidt switching parties and the speaker being involved, Speaker Jace Bolger being involved in that. I think that kind of activity is pretty commonplace today. The strategists on both sides are constantly looking for that leg up. And the question come Wednesday morning is how are you going to work together? What are you going to do to get done? And right now in the Michigan legislature, because it is so highly one-sided Republican right now, for the past 2 years, the Democrats have been relegated to a backbencher status where they haven't used that as a negotiating tactic to get things done very often. Instead, it has been positioning for the next race. And I think that's really unfortunate. You see it from both parties, though, and you see it on the federal level with Congress. We have big budget issues that need to be dealt with yet this year. And if Congress goes back into session and it's simply more fighting, if Obama wins, it's getting to the stage of real irresponsibility. If we're talking about government shutdowns and we're talking about just not being able to operate anymore, there has to come a point when everybody gets past this and begins to work to get things done.
Well, I think the fact Congress has an approval rating of, what, 11%?
Well, but voters, I think, are to blame for this as well because, you know, we have seen a very inactive Congress during this past session, and that's because they really cannot cooperate to get things done. You know, no matter who wins the election, they're going to have to deal with the Congress that they have, mm-hmm. and it's not going to be a Congress that is going to be likely to get a whole lot done. But what happens is, and we've seen this again and again recently, that if you are seen as a legislator who is willing to compromise, you lose the primary to somebody who promises that they will not compromise with the other side when they're sent to Congress. And we've seen through, you know, the way that redistricting is done in many states that you have districts where people are sent to Congress by courting the extreme to either the right or the left, depending upon which way their district is drawn.
Right.
And so you get people in Congress who then do refuse to compromise and see that as a weakness, and you don't have the statesmen that you had in the past. You have people who are always thinking about that next election and do not want to ever be seen as weak. And it's unfortunate that we have a situation where voters have agreed that they see compromise as something that's a weakness in a politician.
A similar dynamic is in play in the Michigan legislature. The state political parties, these are not grassroots parties that are built from the ground up in church basements. These are big businesses, and they never stop operating. And if you look at the Michigan legislature, we have 110 reps and 38 senators. If only the House is on the ballot this year. If you look at those 110 races, only about a quarter of them are even remotely competitive tomorrow. Hmm. Most of those races have already been decided. They've been decided by redistricting. They've been both parties are complicit in this. The Republicans have the upper hand right now, but the Democrats have had the upper hand in past decades. And both parties are complicit in making sure that many of the races are not competitive after the August primary. Who votes in August? Party stalwarts on both sides.
Right.
So you see both parties running to the edges, running to the extremes in the August primary in order to court the base. And that's what's winning in the primary. When you get to the general, most of the listeners of this show today are not really voting for the state house tomorrow. The race is already decided. It's based on historical voting patterns. Mm-hmm. There are about two dozen races that are up for grabs. Both parties want it that way. They don't want to have to spend big money in 110 different races. Both parties are complicit in this system, and I think it's disenfranchisement in terms of Michigan politics.
Vince, what do you hear as you get the listener comments and the listener emails responding to coverage? And I mean, you're the one that really addresses that when you talk to people. What are you hearing this election cycle?
Well, everyone that calls, not everyone, many people who call because they believe that they've heard bias in a particular story or in how we've covered an issue. Usually when a caller is calling to complain about bias, their real complaint is that we did not demonstrate the bias that they would have demonstrated if they had the opportunity to do the story. Most of the time I can talk to an individual about how we put the story together and we can end the phone call understanding what took place. There's a real misunderstanding, I think, on a lot of people's parts about how journalism is done and the amount of power that we do or we don't have. The calls that I find frustrating are the individuals who call and are very angry that we are refusing to cover something that they know is true because they got an email about it from their aunt or their cousin or the guy down the street. And they are talking about something that, in fact, is not true. But those are the calls that are most frustrating is when somebody calls and says, you know, why are you in the media refusing to cover this issue? And the answer is often because, well, it's wrong. And you can point them to a number of different places, but at the end of the phone call, they still won't believe you that it's wrong. They think you're part of a vast media conspiracy cover-up of some sort of piece of information.
I'll give you a couple thoughts about media, but I'll first say I am extraordinarily biased when it comes to media because I've been in the business for mm-hmm. almost a quarter century. You know, one question is the media to blame for what's going on in politics? And I think that needs to be looked at a couple of different ways. One of my biases is I think from a print media perspective, I think in Michigan, I think our traditional newsrooms, our newspapers, and I would put public radio in this category too, have done an extraordinary job this year. explaining ballot proposals to people, covering the issues and covering the candidates. And it's extraordinary because they're doing more with less than they've done at any time in my professional lifetime.
In terms of resources.
In terms of resources. Yeah. And I think they are working their tails off, and I think they deserve a lot of credit for that. Add to that some new models, Bridge Magazine, our publication being one of them, working to do in-depth work. Add to that other nonprofit organizations like Publius.org, where you can go on today and get your ballot printed out right down to the dog catcher race. You know what you're facing. Those are great resources for voters. As complimentary as I am to some of those things, I think another part of the media is definitely to blame for the tenor of things in this country and in this state. And I'm not sure how talk radio hosts sleep at night on both sides. I don't care if you're a Rush Limbaugh fan or a Rachel Maddow fan. I think they're both extremely irresponsible, and they're not helping this country one bit.
Lots to think about as we head to the polls tomorrow. John Bibo of the Center for Michigan, publishing Bridge Magazine, and Vince Duffy of Michigan Radio, our news director. Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's always good to be here. Thanks.
Our final conversation with the candidates who want your vote for state Supreme Court. We're going to speak with Judge Connie Marie Kelly, and that's in 5 minutes coming up here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, with Election Day just hours away, we got to wondering what obstacles exist for voters in our state. For much of the summer and into the fall, the big story about voting in Michigan was the decree from Secretary of State Ruth Johnson that ballot applications had to contain a checkbox for voters to declare that, yes, they are citizens. That controversy was doused last month by federal judge Paul Borman. He ordered Secretary Johnson to stop enforcing the checkbox. So when you get your ballot on Tuesday, you should not see the checkbox. But in an article in Bridge Magazine, writer Chris Andrews says there may be still some surprises or challenges at the polls. Chris, what do you see as the main surprises that could be in store for Michigan voters?
Well, I think that one of the issues that some people will face is that they're precincts have changed. Every 10 years after the redistricting, some of the precincts change in the congressional districts and legislative districts. And so some folks will have moved. They should have gotten something in the mail. That doesn't always happen, and you need to make sure that you know where you're voting. The other thing probably is that the Secretary of State's office has begun an electronic scanning of driver's licenses, which in many senses is no big deal, but it's something that's just kind of different, and for some voters they find it a little unnerving that they're not quite sure why the government is swiping their card. The answer is they're doing it because in these modern days it's a quick way to get access to your voter record. If you're really uncomfortable with it, you can just ask them to type in your name, but that's an issue as well.
That may or may not happen. Is that happening across the state?
It is being phased in,
okay.
So you may find that this election you might not.
If you don't have a driver's license, don't have photo ID, you still can cast a ballot, can't you?
That's right, you can, and that's certainly an area that it's not new, but it's confusing every year. You can sign an affidavit that says you don't have that with you or you don't have it at all, and they will still give you a ballot.
Let's talk about first-time voters. We've got a 19-year-old daughter, and she's living away from home on Michigan State's campus. So we took her to get an absentee ballot. But there are some hooks for these first-time absentee voters, right?
There are, and the biggest hook is that if you want to cast an absentee ballot, and if you don't want to drive from Lansing to back to Ann Arbor or wherever you're to your home, it's far less convenient to be able to do that. The reason is that the law requires that if you have registered to vote at some kind of a voter registration drive, that your first vote has to be at your site. Now, if you took your daughter to the Secretary of State's office, you've actually solved the problem because you've already shown the state that you are who you are, say you are, and so you don't have that problem. But for a lot of college kids, they register to vote for the first time during some kind of an activity on campus, and their place of residence is still their hometown. And for those folks, they have not been able to vote absentee the first time.
Chris, thanks for talking with us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Chris Andrews is a writer. His recent article, Voting Can Be Tricky Business in Michigan, appeared in Bridge Magazine. And continuing our conversations with the candidates for Michigan Supreme Court. Today, we are joined by candidate Connie Marie Kelly, currently a judge in the Family Division of the Wayne County Circuit Court. Welcome, Judge Kelly.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little about what impelled you to enter this race.
You know, it's been such an interesting year, and it's been an amazing journey. I've met so many wonderful people. But I am a judge in the Wayne County Circuit Court, as you said, a family division judge, and I also was instrumental in creating a domestic violence prevention court, so I sit on that court as well. Before I was elected to the bench, I was a lawyer for 27 years, so I have about 31 years of legal experience, and I have been in the trenches, you know, representing people every day. Now I'm on the other side of the bench, and I just feel like I have a really good overall view of what people go through when they go to court and how frightening it is for many people. And so I just feel that I could bring my practical experience in the trenches to the Michigan Supreme Court.
What is your personal view of the role of a state Supreme Court justice?
You know, judges are different than partisan candidates, and that's one of the problems that we have, I think, currently, that the legislature makes the law and the judges enforce the law that exists. Sometimes when the law isn't written clearly, the judges are called upon to interpret that, but in most cases, the law is really written pretty clearly, and it's the judges' job on the Supreme Court to determine what that law is and to enforce it.
What do you think, and what is your opinion of future Supreme Courts overruling past high court decisions?
Now, that's been the subject of a lot of controversy, and the reason is really pretty simple, that, you know, this doctrine of stare decisis or legal precedent is really the cornerstone of our judicial system in this country. And the purpose of not overturning precedent unless there's compelling reasons to do so is to provide, you know, the citizens of our country and our state the ability to know what is expected of them. This is what the law is, and so I plan my life accordingly. I follow the law. Businesses plan what they need to do based on the law that exists. So, you know, precedents that have been well examined and have a body of case law that have developed around that particular decision should not be overturned unless there are really compelling reasons to do that. There must be clear errors of law in order to overturn existing precedents.
In recent years, if you can look back, what do you feel are the one or two most significant actions of Michigan Supreme Court?
Well, you know, even this year, the Supreme Court has had a tremendous impact on the election. There are so many ballot proposals that even though there were enough signatures gathered and they were submitted timely, it was really the Supreme Court who is the final arbiter, the final decision maker as to whether those proposals would actually be on the ballot. And I think that has really given the Michigan Supreme Court great visibility. A lot of people think, well, what does the Michigan Supreme Court have to do with me? But I think they've seen some things like that that have impacted, you know, their ability to vote on issues that are important to our state. I also think another hot topic I hear as I've traveled around the state is last year the legislature decided that certain pensions could be taxed, and the Supreme Court found that to be constitutional by a 4-3 vote. And a lot of seniors talk about that as they travel around the state, so that was another way I think that they got to see how the Supreme Court affects their daily lives.
Are there any issues, Judge Connie Kelly, on which you would feel you would have to recuse yourself?
No, I don't think that there are any.
Okay. Getting past the election, looking ahead after November 6th, what do you see as the biggest challenges that the high court is facing?
Well, you know, a function of the court, besides making opinions and rendering decisions that affect all the citizens of the state, the court is also charged with the responsibility of running all the courts throughout the state of Michigan. So I think it's really important that we provide a high-quality legal system to the citizens of the state and yet be good stewards of the taxpayers' money. And there's a number of different ideas that I have about how to do that. I like problem-solving courts. Like in Wayne County, we have a drug court and a mental health court. And, for instance, in the drug court, you know, a person can receive substance abuse treatment at the cost of $3,500 compared to a year of incarceration, which is $35,000. And so by employing these creative ideas, we can help someone overcome, of course, these are only nonviolent offenders, but to help someone overcome a drug problem, make them a more productive member of society, and at the same time, save taxpayers money. The same is true with our mental health court. We have saved almost 1,700 nights of jail beds in the first 30 months of the mental health court by providing people with the help they need rather than incarcerating them. And I'd like to see those kinds of courts in use throughout the state.
I'd like to touch on something that you alluded to earlier, and that is the issue of partisanship. Considering that you as candidates need to raise money to run, you're backed by a party, and then you're on the nonpartisan part of the ballot. I get the sense in talking to other candidates as well, judicial candidates are not comfortable with that, with the perception that there might be some sticky fingerprints down the road because of donations and partisan backing. What would you do to change the way that Supreme Court candidates must run in Michigan?
You know, it's difficult for the candidates, and it's confusing for voters because candidates have to be nominated by a party to be on the Supreme Court ballot, and yet then they're placed in the nonpartisan section of the ballot. So it's confusing for voters, and it is troublesome for the candidates. There's a great reform package that has been proposed, and it would make these judicial elections less partisan. And besides making them less partisan, I think it's also important to try to take the money out of these judicial races. You know, I think our country is weary of the partisan divide. You know, we're tired of seeing it in Washington. We're tired of seeing it in Lansing. And people expect the courts, especially the Supreme Court of our state, to be above the politics of the day. And so I think that's what the Michigan Supreme Court needs to work harder at. We have to make sure that the decisions that are made based upon the law and not about any political ideology or any loyalties to special interests. We really need to make sure that the public has confidence that the court is deciding, making their decisions based on the law.
Judge Connie-Kelly, talk to the voters listening to you right now and explain why you think you deserve a seat on the state's highest court.
Well, thank you. You know, I have 31 years of legal experience, and I raised two sons, and I raised my niece as well. And, you know, and that was because of a substance abuse problem that my brother and his wife had. So I think I bring a different kind of life experience to the court. I paid my own way through college and law school. There were six children in my family. And so that was the only way that I could go. So, you know, I've been in the trenches. I value my education. And I've been out in the community doing things in addition to my legal experience. I started a girls mentoring program for the girls at Cody High School in Detroit. I love my Cody Girls Make It Happen group. And I feel that my 31 years of legal experience plus my personal life experience will bring a different perspective to the Michigan Supreme Court. And I would be so humbled and honored if the citizens of the state would help me to get there.
Connie Marie Kelly, currently a judge in the Family Division of the Wayne County Circuit Court and a candidate for Michigan Supreme Court. Thanks for talking with us today, Judge.
My pleasure. Thank you. And don't forget to vote.
June, July, August, and September. Those are the most popular months to say, I do. With those months long gone, though, some newly married ones might be wondering just what to do with the wedding leftovers, especially the all-important wedding dress. Well, the Brides Project in Ann Arbor has a unique way for brides to find a good home for their wedding dress after the big day is over. And all of the money raised goes straight to the cancer support community of Greater Ann Arbor. Executive Director Barb Hiltz joins us now. Barb, my friend Lynn, who first told me about the Brides Project, put it perfectly. She said, I love this idea so much, I want to marry it. How did you manage to blend brides and the cancer support community?
It's a great sort of juxtaposition, isn't it?
It is.
The idea for the Brides Project came from a local Ann Arbor woman named Monique Slimers, who heard about a woman named Helen Sweet in Toronto who was doing something similar and liked the idea of raising money. And then Helen in Toronto was giving the money that she raised to cancer charities. And Monique herself had been touched by cancer. Her dad was diagnosed with lung cancer. And so all of this really spoke to her personally. And she wanted to bring the idea here.
And the idea being?
The idea is a business that raises money for the cancer support community. So we are a bridal boutique where all of the money goes to charity. So we collect wedding dresses from all over the country. About 3/4 of them have been donated by brides who have already worn them, already loved them, and often already cleaned them and stored them away. And then they hear about the Brides Project and think, wouldn't it be lovely to give my gown that meant so much to me a second life? The other 1/4 of them come from shops, from boutiques around the country who have perhaps overstock. They may be floor samples, but they're brand new gowns that they donate to the project. And then we sell them for really deeply discounted prices.
So give me an idea. If I walked in, if I was a bride-to-be and I needed a dress and I walked into the Brides Project shop, what would I find?
Well, lots of gowns, first of all. More selection than most bridal boutiques have. Right now, we've got 335 gowns in the shop in the inventory. And the average gown in the boutique sells for $350. So that is, anyone who knows the wedding industry, so much less than you'll find gowns for in traditional shops. So they sell for at least 50% from what they would sell for originally in a shop.
So when you launch this, what were you hoping to make and what did you wind up making?
Well, we hoped that in our first year open, I mean, most businesses, when you open, your goal is to not lose money.
Yes,
right?
Of course.
So we thought because we're run by volunteers, because we operate in donated space, we perhaps could raise $25,000. That was our goal in the first year. In the first year, we raised almost $70,000. We just celebrated our 1-year anniversary.
Knowing that there are so many worthy nonprofits and charities that are trying to stay alive in a challenging economy, yes, things are picking up, but it's still challenging. And the quest for funds, it's a never-ending quest. You know that as executive director. There are golf outings, and there are black tie affairs, and there are costume parties, and there are bachelor auctions. So those have had their place, but what you're doing, I think other groups could learn from, couldn't they?
I think so. Like many nonprofits, we don't charge for the services that we provide. They're all free. Families touched by cancer have got enough financial stress in their lives, and I think that's true of a lot of nonprofits. And there are only so many events that you can do. They are very time, staff intensive, and we no longer live in a world where we can go to businesses and corporations with our hand out and expect that that can be our primary way of raising funds. So I do think that the future of nonprofits is to start thinking outside of the norm a little. What are some revenue-generating, more sustainable sources for income and moving away from some of those traditional fundraising?
You must have seen over this past year of the first year some very lovely stories of people who perhaps, you know, feel like you say they're kind of fighting cancer by donating the dress, and people who found the dress of their dreams at a price they could afford. It's got to be a happy place to be.
People are moved by this, and everybody leaves proud that they were involved, whether they donated a pair of shoes or a dress or whether they're purchasing. They're proud that they've been a part of something. And many of them actually, people who will buy dresses at the Brides Project, want to let their guests know. They'll write something in their program or on their tables at their reception to tell them that they bought their dress at the Brides Project and how their gown is changing lives.
Barb Hiltz is the executive director of the Cancer Support Community of Greater Ann Arbor, incorporating this wonderful Brides Project. And you can find out lots more by going to the website, thebridesproject.org. Thank you so much for sharing with us. It was fun talking with
you.
Thank you
for having me.
And be sure to join us tomorrow. We will, of course, keep you up to date on all things election 2012 here in Michigan. And a special treat, legendary singer Betty LaVette is going to stop by the studios. We'll talk about her new autobiography and her new CD. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineered by Bob Scon. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk again tomorrow at 3.